Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello, thanks for listening and welcome to Interchange. Today is June 7th, 2011. My name's Dave Stewart, and I'm very happy to have as my guest today Dr. Fabio Rojas, a professor in the Department of Sociology at Indiana University. Professor Rojas, welcome to Interchange.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Okay, we're going to talk about three things. Well, we might talk about more than three things, but I have three things planned. First, you were part of a survey which was presented on the anti-war movement. Then we'll kind of segue into a discussion of sociology. And then I'd like to talk about your book, which was published in 2007 by the Johns Hopkins University Press, entitled From Black Power to Black Studies. But let's talk about the survey first. Professor Rojas, what was the survey and why did you do it?
Thank you, David. Let me start with a very brief description of what we did. My collaborator is Michael Heaney, who teaches political science and organization studies at the University of Michigan. And in 2004, shortly after we had completed our doctoral degrees at the University of Chicago, Michael called me up and said, "Fabio, would you please help me with a survey?" And then I said, "Yeah, I'd love to help you with a survey. What is the survey of?" He said, "I would like to study people who are protesting at the Republican National Convention in New York City." At the time, he was a postdoctoral student at Yale University, and he had this idea of going down to New York City to do on-the-street interviews with people who were protesting George Bush and the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. And I thought this was a very good idea because social scientists who study political movements often have very limited data. So, for example, if you want to study, say, the French Revolution, you're kind of stuck with whatever historical records happen to be in the archives in France. However, I thought this is a really great opportunity. We have this huge movement. A lot of people were upset about the Iraq War. They're upset about the presidency of George Bush. There was a lot of controversy. And for social scientists, it was an ideal situation when 1 million people who you want to study are all in one place at one time. And I said, that sounds like a great opportunity. Let's study that movement. And so that started in 2004 in August and in New York City, in the study of the Republican National Nominating Convention. And we've continued a survey to survey anti-war activists and protesters since 2004 up till the present. So we've been doing that for 7 years. And the primary goal is to get firsthand accounts of why people are showing up, what the grievances are, who recruited them, and so forth.
Okay, so Michael Heaney and you do this study and a survey on the anti-war movement. Now, I guess the question is, how much exposure has it got? I found, and the reason why I'm doing this interview with you is because I read a website entitled Black Agenda Report. I also read Counterpunch. Those are the two main ways where I get my news. But when I was reading Black Agenda Report, I saw an article saying there is no anti-war movement. Now, I don't know whether you agree with that conclusion, but it had you and Michael Heaney, the survey in there. And I wonder, how much other exposure has it gotten?
Right. Well, we've been very lucky to have received a lot of media attention for this particular study. The specific article that that you're referring to was published in a journal called Mobilization. It's an academic journal that specializes in studies of political movements. And we published a paper showing that if you look at anti-war activists, people who showed up to protests, from 2007 to 2010, you see a huge decline in the number of self-identified Democrats. So that was a very eye-catching finding. A lot of people were interested in that finding. And people started saying, hey, that shows that people weren't interested in the war. They were actually interested in anti-George Bush sentiment. As soon as Barack Obama got nominated and elected and inaugurated, the Democrats took off, leaving the core movement very small and in recession. And so that paper was published a few months ago, and we've been lucky to have been picked up by a number of news media outlets, such as certain blogs, such as Andrew Sullivan's blog, which is a very prominent blog, The Wall Street Journal covered us, Fox News covered us, ABC News, NPR, a number of other news outlets have covered that because of its very stark finding that there was actually a substantial decrease in the percentage of self-identified Democrats at anti-war protests.
I'm going to read from that article, Professor Rojas. It said the new study was put together by Michael Heaney of the University of Michigan and Fabio Rojas of Indiana University. It shows essentially that many Democrats were motivated to pick up peace placards and shout anti-war slogans more by their dislike of George Bush and the Republicans than for genuine opposition to America's multiple wars around the globe, wars that Obama has expanded upon while adding his own theaters of war. Now, those comments right there were by Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report. Now, here's a quote from Professor Heaney. Professor Heaney puts it this way, quote, "The anti-war movement should have been furious at Obama's betrayal and reinvigorated its protest activity. Instead, says Heaney, attendance at anti-war rallies declined precipitously and financial resources available to the movement have dissipated." The professor concluded that, quote, "The election of Obama appeared to be a demobilizing force on the anti-movement, on the anti-war movement, even in the face of his pro-war decisions."
Yes, I think we all agree on the basic finding, which is that Democrats used to constitute a large fraction, a large number of the people used to show up at anti-war events, and they've stopped showing up. The evidence is actually very clear on that. I think where Michael and I may disagree with some of the interpretations in the media is exactly what does that mean? So, for example, I would say that, you know, there's a consistent dislike of war amongst a lot of protesters over time. However, I think the mitigating factor is the degree of threat perceived by people. So here's another example that I think is very informative. In 2010, the Congress and the Obama administration passed the Healthcare Reform Act, and there were protests by conservatives at the time. However, there had been earlier expansions of things like Medicare during the George Bush administration, but there weren't as many protests then.
There were not as many?
Very few protests. And I cannot remember many anti-Medicare Part D protests, even though that was an expansion of healthcare coverage that would conflict with a lot of conservative political philosophy, right? And I think the interpretation is pretty straightforward, that conservatives are genuinely concerned about the size of government. But when somebody on your side does it, you're willing to give them a little bit more slack. It's not as personally threatening as it is when somebody from the other side does it. And I think a similar process is at work with the Democratic Party and the anti-war movement, which is when somebody from the other side does it, it inflames your emotions a lot more than when somebody from your side does it. And it's that perceived threat that is really the core finding of our paper.
Let's do talk about the paper a little bit and talk about the methodology. You said you interviewed people from a 7-year period, and that this report is from basically from 2007 to 2010. How do you go about doing a survey?
Correct. This data is based on a study we conducted from 2007 to 2010. What we do is we've subscribed to email lists that political groups organize. We know a lot of the movement leaders personally, so we know when all the big events are going to happen. Then what we do for as many events as possible, we organize a team of surveyors. So this is literally me or Michael or one of my associates and a team of between maybe 4, 5, 6, 7, up to 10 undergraduates and graduate students. We show up at a protest. We kind of roughly map out the area of the protest, and we assign people different sections of the protest, and we walk through it in the same way that an exit poller would do it. Every 5 people, we count out 5 people, and then we interview that person and move through the crowd so that we are randomly picking people through the crowd and not just the first person who walks by. And we give each person a short 2-page survey, which asks people a little bit about their background, their age, their gender, their sex, their party affiliation, why they're showing up, and so forth. And then usually the second page has a rotating set of questions that depends on what's happening politically at that moment. So, for example, in March of 2008, we asked people, do you like Hillary Clinton better than Barack Obama? Then in November of 2008, we asked, do you like Obama better than John McCain? So we have a nice set of questions where we have some basic background questions that are constant throughout the study going back to 2004, but rotating questions that we add because we're interested in whatever's happening at that time. So the specific paper that we that you're talking about uses data from 5,000 people. These are people who've shown up at anti-war protests on the street in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, and so forth. And one of the questions we simply asked is, which party do you identify with? You know, we gave them Republican, Democrat, Green, Libertarian, Reform, whole list of parties. They could write in one, they could write something in if we didn't cover their party. And just simply tracking the number, the percentage of people who reported they were Democrats declined significantly during the course of the study from about 45 to 50% to about 20% at the time of Obama's inauguration.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, then, okay, so that's one statistic that you got out of this survey.
Mm-hmm.
But you also said, Professor Rojas, that you also asked people why they were there. Now, you took 5,000 responses and were able to map that out according to how many Democrats. So I guess two questions. One, why would somebody participate in an anti-war demonstration? And two, what is the statistical method that you can accurately say from maybe 100 people, that means 100,000 people feel this way?
Right. So in general, the thing to remember with surveys is that they rely on the idea of sampling. So if, say, a million people in America are involved in some form of anti-war activism, that doesn't mean you have to interview all 1 million to get an accurate picture. Instead, you draw a random sample of people showing up to these events. So this is a random sample of protesters. That's what this is a study of. And then what we do is we have an open form question, which just says, what are the most important reasons that you showed up for today's event? And they can write in anything that they want. So that's one measurement of kind of the person's immediate grievance. Like, what is the one thing that's really drawing you here? Then using those surveys, we can then enter those into something as simple as an Excel spreadsheet. And then that can be analyzed using more sophisticated software. And what we do specifically is we read the answers, and through years of experience and experimenting with different systems, we've come up with a system of categorizing and coding the answers.
So what was the answer?
So obviously the top two or three answers, number one is obviously war-related issues. But then the other thing, which is not surprising in lieu of the paper, but was surprising when we first read it, was that a lot of people are specifically oriented against the Republican Party or George Bush. So the crowd is really a mixture of people who you could say are topically oriented and a mix combined with people who are partisans. You know, people are there because they have a political allegiance to a party. I am not happy with Republicans. I am not happy with George Bush. This war is just one example of the same thing. So that's what really draws people out. In the same way that a Tea Party protester may say, my gosh, this is another example of Democrats screwing up America, so they decide to show up to the protest. Then there's some other very interesting reasons that people show up, which aren't mentioned quite as often. So for example, a lot of people are here to show solidarity with the movement. You know, my friends are showing up. I want to show solidarity. I want to show that this movement is not as small as people say. I want my voice heard. So when you read the answers and you analyze them statistically, you find this a combination of a topic-specific issue, the war, combined with a partisan tilt, you know, maybe Cheney, maybe Bush, or a number of people who were mentioned very often, combined with a very social aspect where people are saying, I'm showing up because I have a relationship with this movement.
Now, you mentioned movement.
Correct.
So you're studying a movement, and this is an ideal chance for us to kind of segue into the study of, well, perhaps is part of the study of sociology is. So do you study movements?
That's correct. I'm a specialist in what's called social movements and organizations. It's kind of a new specialty within sociology that's emerged in the last 5 or 10 years. And basically, for a long time, people who studied organizations such as, you know, universities, for-profit groups, and so forth, that was considered a special specialty than people who studied, you know, people with picket signs and protests and rallies. Then we made the very natural realization, which is a lot of times people are protesting the institutions. So maybe there should be some interplay between those two areas. And so I'm at that intersection now where I'm studying political protest, especially as it happens around political parties, schools, universities, and so forth.
So in other words, like, you're studying the relationship between social movements and mainstream politics. Wait, now that's something that we talked about before the show, but is that consistent with what you said just then?
That is correct. This where the two meet, where the guy with the protest sign, the picket sign, meets the guy in the suit. That's what I'm studying.
Okay. And now we've got about 1 or 2 minutes before the break, but why did you choose that? Why did you choose that topic?
It was a topic that was really understudied by previous sociology, and I thought it was something that really needed to be addressed and affects our everyday lives as well.
How does it affect our everyday life?
So, for example, you may show up when you go shopping. The products are often regulated by the government, and those regulations were often pushed by social movements.
Oh, so your consumer behavior is a result of
what some movement has done in the past.
Okay. We're going to enter our first break. When we come back, I'm going to continue talking with Professor Fabio Rojas of the Department of Sociology of Indiana University, and we're going to go into the study of sociology.
Support for WFHB comes from X Printwear and Promotions, specializing in corporate apparel, athletic wear, promotional products, business cards, and letterhead. X Printwear is located on Bloomington's west side. More information is available at xprintwear.com. Support for WFHB also comes from Midwest Audio Recording, offering professional recording services in the heart of downtown Bloomington. With over 20 years' experience, Midwest Audio produces demos and CDs for local artists and national acts. More information online at MidwestAudioRecording.com.
Welcome back to Interchange. My name is Dave Stewart. I'm talking with Professor Fabio Rojas of the Department of Sociology here at Indiana University. At the end of our very nice discussion in the first segment, we were talking about a specific topic in sociology, specifically the study of the relationship between social movements and mainstream politics. And I'd like to continue talking about that later, but before I'd like to take a step back. And Professor Rojas, what is the study of sociology?
Yeah, sociology is an academic discipline that's dedicated to studying how people relate to each other, how they act in social situations, such as at work, in family, voting, and so forth. And it's a field that actually goes back 150 years. And it comes from the observation, the basic, most fundamental observation of sociology is that people really care about what other people think about them. We're constantly in this web of social interactions. And so that is the idea that motivates a lot of sociology. And I think that's a very good summary of what sociologists do. We study how we act in the context and the presence of other people.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. That's something that we do in our daily life. How does it become an academic discipline?
Right. Well, in order to become an academic discipline, and yes, I agree, it's oodles of fun. I would say that in order to become an academic discipline, you have to show that you're creating a body of knowledge. In the same way that a chemist might say, look, I've proven this is how water is made, this is how energy works, that's what they do in physics and chemistry, you have to build a body of knowledge that really explains why people act the way they do. So, for example, in studies of voting, there's a lot of research showing that certain kinds of people tend to vote more often than others. There are different studies that show that some people tend to vote Republican rather than Democrat. Right, so there's a body of research that's based on evidence that you can talk about, that you can criticize, that you can test. And that's what helps develop an idea, a community of scholars who are just talking into a real academic discipline. And so sociology is a discipline in that respect. We have studies, we do field site visits, we'll visit places and observe people interacting in the wild, so to say. We'll do interviews like the kind that we were just talking about. We may do surveys, you know, over the telephone, call up 3,000 people and do a survey. What do you think of President Obama today? And all of this action, all this survey taking and knowledge building and data building is really designed to help us come up with a theory of how people interact with each other.
Now, I might be wrong, but it seems like a lot of what I'm steered towards when I listen to mainstream and corporate media, which I do all the time, is how do I make money from it? So is that a goal of sociology, is that you study and provide this knowledge so that somebody can make a profit?
Well, I would like to get paid, so I would certainly admit that I'm looking for a profit. But in general, I would say that, you know, we're like the physical sciences, the social sciences. We create a body of knowledge, and we're doing it because we want to know if it's true, right? And then it's up to different people to decide what they can do with it. And so there are some people who do hire sociologists in a for-profit context. So, for example, there are actually sociologists who will watch people go shopping to figure out, you know, what they like, how they shop in the presence of their friends and so forth. And that's a for-profit context. And then there are other people who pursue sociological research in the pursuit of nonprofit topics.
Such as?
So, for example, healthcare behavior. So, for example, there's a lot of discussion right now among sociologists about the degree to which your friends influence your health behavior. So, for example, maybe if you quit smoking, I'll quit smoking too. Or maybe it goes the other way. If you start smoking, I'll smoke more too. And smoking is an issue of great public concern because, to be blunt, smoking shortens your life. It's a very bad habit to have, to be blunt about it. But the decision to smoke and to start smoking is a social one. So that's a nonprofit context where we want to see some concrete change in the social world. And we're researching it because we want to see the world become a better place. And then finally, there's just a lot of knowledge for knowledge's sake, right? So where you say, you know, this does not have an immediate application, but it's good to know. This is intrinsically interesting. And so sociology is a broad discipline that includes for-profit motives, non-profit motives, and purely academic intellectual pursuits.
So what you're saying, Professor Rojas, is that somebody, if they were interested in the interaction among people and wanted to kind of pursue that study and take it to the next level, so to speak, and build a body of knowledge, that they might be able to get a job out of studying that.
Yes, I agree. There's actually a lot of, I think, untapped potential for sociology. And already, you know, I teach a lot of undergraduates, and we can see that a lot of people want to go into teaching, may take an undergraduate degree in sociology, social work, healthcare, and so forth. A lot of people in those fields start out as sociology majors. And also, I think that we're really an untapped resource in the academy because we're, compared to other disciplines, we're relatively small. And so we fly under the radar sometimes. But sometimes our ideas are picked up. And I think it's true that we provide a really good set of tools and critical thinking skills that can be used in a more applied context.
Well, when I was preparing for this interview, I was looking at, I Googled your name, Fabio Rojas, and one of the links that came up was this fascinating discussion between a bunch of sociologists and a bunch of economists. Mm-hmm. And it was quite funny. What is the relationship between sociology and economy? What would the Department of Economics?
Right. Well, that's a question that I think about a lot because one of my other research topics is academic disciplines, as we'll speak about later. But I would say on the deepest level, economists and sociologists are actually on the same page. We're both interested in how the social world is put together, right? And that is what really unites us, and that is why we're both called social scientists. However, in the way that we carry out the research, the way that we carry out the research can be very different. So, for example, economists are known for what's called the rational actor model, which basically says, well, what each person does is they list, if you want to explain somebody's behavior, what you should do is you should say, here are the different options that a person faces, and they're going to choose the one that best maximizes their own personal utility or interest.
The rational choice.
Right. That's called the rational choice model. And, you know, the model has a lot of appealing aspects to it. It's simple to state. You can make it mathematical. It's very easy to turn into a computer model and so forth. It's very easy to work with. It's very easy to explain. And it does fit a lot of circumstances. So, for example, you know, why pay $200 for the TV if you can get the same one for $100? Right. And there are a lot of situations where, you know, money and these kind of cost benefit decisions are very important. Now, where sociology is different is that, first of all, we employ a wide range of methods, where economists tend to be mostly quantitative. They tend to like statistics more than anything else. They really don't believe a lot of research unless it's quantitatively proved, where sociology is a lot more heterogeneous.
What do you mean by that? What's heterogeneous?
Oh, well, there's a wider diversity of research tools. So, for example, we'll do a case study where we'll visit an organization. Then we might conduct a survey and then do a statistical analysis of it. It's much more a holistic in our approach to human relationships than what you might find in economics research. And what I think is really interesting is that they're really complementary approaches, where you say, well, one approach is all about looking at how people maximize their interests, and the sociological approach is about looking at the picture holistically, looking at it as a whole, how everybody interacts. And that requires a lot of different kinds of evidence that aren't easily shoehorned into a nice, simple mathematical model. So at a deep level, we're on the same team, but I think a lot of the times we disagree on exactly how things should be carried out.
Well, talk about a little bit about the sociology department here at Indiana University. Like what within the sociology department, what kind of things are studied?
Well, Indiana's sociology department is a very well-respected department. We're very well-regarded within the world of sociology. I consider myself very lucky to be teaching here. And we're known for a few specialties. Number one, we're known for studies of education. We have a lot of very highly regarded scholars of education. That's one of the reasons I think that they hired me a long time ago, because my book, which we'll talk about later, is about the rise of Black studies programs at universities.
Correct.
And so I thought, you know, that it was a good place to be if you wanted to study people who are protesting universities, because we study education a lot. We also are very strong in the area of medical sociology, and that's the study. There are a number of topics that medical sociologists study. One thing they study is how your status, whether you're poor or rich or middle class or whatnot or working class, how that affects your health. Medical sociologists also study medical professions. So, for example, why is it that doctors are so influential in society, right? Why are nurses less influential than doctors? So these questions of power and influence and status are studied by medical sociologists. We're also very good in a number of other topics, such as political sociology. We have a number of people who are studying protests and politics and voting behavior and the welfare state. And we're also very good in the sociology of science. We have a number of scholars who are very well known for studying the science as a profession and as a social activity.
Let's go to the first topic, the study of sociology studying education.
Yes.
The one where you wrote your book, the book entitled, I've got it right in my hands, From Black Power to Black Studies. I've read the book, I'm proud to say. It was a tough read for me because I had to read it slowly. And your method of writing is very nice. You lay out kind of what you're going to cover, then you cover it, and then you conclude it. But within every sentence, I felt I was learning stuff. So I kind of want to try to go through it. But let's start with the title. It's From Black Power to Black Studies. Now, why did you not say From the Civil Rights Movement to Black Studies?
Right. What the book is about the transition of a political movement to the mainstream. And so in this case, the political movement that was starting with was the Black Power movement, not so much the Civil Rights movement. And so the story I wanted to cover was, how does a very radical political movement make the jump to the mainstream? And the subtitle of the book is called How Radical Political Movement Becomes an Academic Discipline.
Uh-huh. All right.
So that's the case of people with pickets meeting people with suits. And if you look at photos of black student activists from the 1960s, they were, you know, sitting in buildings, they were protesting, they were getting arrested, very kind of edgy stuff. But if you look at a Black Studies department today, you'll see people in ties and suits. So the question is, how do you make that transition? And that ties into a broader question in sociology, which is, how does society change? And one of the ways, it changes in many ways, but one way that it changes is that, you know, people take the time to set up an organized movement and push for change. And so my book is a contribution to that line of thought. How is it that a social movement actually pushes for change and gets their way within the mainstream?
And before we go into talking about it, I have to say that I happen to be Caucasian. You are Latino, Professor mm-hmm. Rojas. And here we are talking about black power and black studies. Do you see a problem with that?
You know, I don't see a problem with it, but it's something that definitely needs to be addressed. Because every social researcher has their own personal interest, their own personal relationship to the story, and is something that I think has to be laid out and discussed and at least acknowledged at the very least. So, for example, somebody who participated in the civil rights movement has a certain perspective. They were there in 1965 or 1966, and that's a very different perspective than somebody like me who's a bit younger who didn't have that firsthand experience. There's also the experience of being black versus non-black in the United States. And I do not have that personal experience of being African American, so that's not my personal history, and I can't write from that stance. However, I do have my own history of, you know, where I grew up, where Latinos were, you know, a small group. I grew up in southern New Jersey. And I went to school in Berkeley, California, where I was exposed to a wide diversity of people. And that started to influence me to think about, wow, you know, look at all these different kinds of people. And then you look and you realize, wow, they have ethnic studies classes. What's the story behind that? And that sat in my head for many years. And that came from my own experience where I was kind of an outsider to a lot of this. And as an outsider, it makes you think a certain particular way. And I got to say that in general, in researching the book, that people were remarkably generous towards me. That, yes, there were some people who didn't feel comfortable talking to a person who was an African American, but I have to say the overwhelming majority of people who like Black Studies, who were the critics of Black Studies, you know, were very open-minded towards me, and they really helped me write the book through interviews and give me papers and so forth. So I have to say that in some cases it was a little bit of a barrier, but most people were very generous, and their generosity made the book possible.
Well, let's do talk about the book. So let's talk about black power.
Sure.
What were the conditions here in America that caused black power to rise?
Right. So black power is usually the phrase that people use to call a certain political movement like the mid to late 60s. And the basic idea of black power was that African Americans should take control of their own institutions. Okay. And so that's the basic definition. Let me tell you why that was such a pressing issue in the 1960s. So for a long time, African Americans had been mobilized against segregation. And that happened over many decades. The groups like the NAACP, they litigated in order to end segregation of schools and segregation of work, and there were many political struggles fought on behalf of desegregation. And then finally, in 1964, there was the Civil Rights Act. There was actually a law saying that, you know, a lot of forms of discrimination at work and in schooling were now prohibited. In addition to that, there have been court cases like the Brown versus Board of Education case, which said you could no longer segregate students based on race. So there was a long fight, and people won the fight. The Civil Rights Movement had its day. They won.
And the Voting Rights Act, right?
Yes, that's okay. Right. So, you know, so there was certain kinds of school and work discrimination were banned. A lot of barriers to voting were now eliminated. So that was a huge turn in American history. And then people started asking things like, what about my life? Okay, May's not legal to segregate me anymore, but I still live in very bad conditions. I may not have running water. I may not have electricity. I may have a job that's very humiliating and degrading. I may have a working class job that I do not like. I may read in the newspapers and they're still demonizing African Americans in the media, right? So after the Civil Rights Act, after the Voting Act, people started saying, look around. You know, there was a lot of promise, but my real life, my daily condition has not changed. And then a couple years later, Martin Luther King was shot. So then people said, oh my God, is this what America has come to? That a man of nonviolence who fought for, you know, over a decade to bring, to end racial segregation in America was shot in cold blood. We have to radicalize. Radicalism is the answer. We have to take control of our own lives.
And that became Black Power.
That became Black Power.
Okay, and then so, and I think in the book it says that after that the they looked at black people looked at jobs and housing and saw that yes, they were there was no segregation and they could vote, but their the promised improvement in jobs and housing had not occurred. So how did what forms of protest did the Black Power movement take when the black people became radicalized?
Well, there are a couple of forms that we remember very well. So, for example, they formed radical political organizations. Probably the most famous one is the group called the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And the idea there was very radical. I mean, they were an openly Marxist group. They said, look, the American capitalist system has failed African Americans. We are going to control our own businesses. They had their own newspaper, their own political party. And they are really going to radicalize and form this group. There were also protests. There were attempts to create black-oriented groups, which are still around. There's also black-oriented culture. You know, we would celebrate our black identity. So if you're from that era, the 1970s, you probably remember the African-style clothes and African-style hair. And that was a big part of that cultural push.
Okay, we're going to enter our second break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking about the book From Black Power to Black Studies with Professor Fabio Rojas of Indiana University.
Support for WFHB comes from Bikesmith's Bicycle Shop, established in 1975. Bikesmith sells Cannondale and Giant bicycles, services all makes, and provides accessories. Open every day, half a block south of the courthouse and half a block east of the Beeline Trail at 112 South College is where you'll find Bikesmith's.
Welcome back to Interchange. Thank you for listening. I am Dave Stewart, and I am talking with Professor Fabio Rojas, a professor in the Sociology Department here at Indiana University. We are talking about the book From Black Power to Black Studies, written by Fabio Rojas. And at the end of the last segment, Professor Rojas, you mentioned that there was the civil rights movement. The promises of change didn't totally occur. Black people got radicalized, they got serious, they were going to take what they wanted. And my question is, what did they want to take?
Well, there were a number of strategies that people pursued once Black Power had emerged as a concept. So for example, some people decided to create their own self-sustaining organizations. So for example, the Black Panther Party we're talking about, they had their own living quarters. You could live in a Black Panther house. They had their own newspaper. And they even had their own breakfast programs where they gave out free food to young people in urban settings who weren't getting enough to eat. So having an independent lifestyle was one example. Another example that was a little bit less radical is to create your own kind of professional or cultural group. So, for example, in that era, you see a lot of things such as the Black Librarians Association, the Association for Black Psychologists. So a lot of people saying, look, we're going to form our own group that's maybe not as radical as the Panthers. Those guys are really, really dangerous. They had a very, you know, very notorious reputation. But what we can do is we can create an organization that serves our own interests as African Americans, an institution that'll speak to us. And then a third strategy is what you might call reform of existing institutions, right? So you may show up and say, well, you know, this business is not addressing African-American concerns. I want this policy or that policy. And that's where we get into my book, where I talk about that third strategy, where black student activists were mobilized within universities, and they said, look, we do not like the college curriculum. It's racist. It focuses on white history. Black history is excluded, and we want it to be different from now on. We want our own courses and our own departments.
And then, so those students were calling for a black studies department. And I believe you go into detail. In fact, I'm pretty sure that you do. But I think it was San Francisco State. So and so, tell me a little bit about how one particular black student movement calling for a black studies department occurred.
Yeah, that's a great example because San Francisco State College is considered to have had the first black studies program. And let me tell you a little bit about what happened because it's a fascinating story. Around 1966 or so, a number of Black Panthers, and the Black Panther Party was based in Oakland. That's where they started. That's where Huey Newton and Bobby Seale were located. That's where they lived. And they started this political group called the Black Panthers. And a few of the Panthers had this idea that they would enroll in various colleges, not really to get their education, even though I'm sure they were taking courses. But the real reason was to mobilize other black students. There was a group of people who needed to be brought together and radicalized, and they would start the revolution on different campuses. And there was one fellow named Jimmy Garrett, and he was a member of the Black Panther Party, and he still lives around San Francisco to this day. And he became a student at San Francisco State College, and he started meeting other black students saying, hey, have you considered joining a group? Have you considered protesting? And he kind of collected people together, and he formed that crucial link between the Panthers and some of these other black organizations and black student groups.
Form a group. So Garrett would say, form a group to do what?
Right. So the initial group was called, I believe, the Black Student Association. And then he renamed it the Black Student Union, or somebody renamed it the Black Student Union. And the idea was that that would be the launching pad for protest on campus, aimed at getting those courses and other policies that were aimed at African Americans, and to really radicalize the campus as a whole.
Okay, and then radicalize the campus. And in the book, it mentions that there was one of the first things to radicalize was that to get more black students to enter into college. Is that right, or am I
correct?
Wrong?
Correct. So what happened was that another person, George Murray, who was another black activist in Oakland, who went to San Francisco State to organize black students. He got into a fight with some white students, as described in the book, and one thing led to another, and then there was a strike on behalf to bring George Murray back to the campus.
Because he was expelled from the fight.
Right, he was expelled due to that fight. Now, what's the link to black studies? Well, the link is this, is that once he was expelled, that created an issue that a lot of people could rally around because he was popular, people liked him, he was very charismatic. He was a bit of a firebrand as well. He said a lot of sensational things that were reported in the national media. So, for example, in September or October of 1968, he was quoted in Newsweek as saying that the Viet Cong were right and it was right to shoot American soldiers. And as you can imagine, that did not go over well. This guy was already, you know, in hot water because of this fight from the semester before. And basically, he finally got expelled after saying that. So he was very charismatic. He was a firebrand. And that created the rallying point. So they said, okay, now that we have this protest on behalf of George Murray to bring George Murray back, hey, we want more black students. We want more financial aid. We want black studies courses. They had a whole list of 10 different demands. So they used this one issue as a spark to start the whole movement on campus, and that's what led to what's called the Third World Liberation Front, the Third World Strike.
Okay, how did the Third World evolve? What happened to it?
Well, what happened with the Third World Strike was this student, George Murray, was expelled. They created a coalition of students, both Asian students, Latino students, white students, and black students. They were called the Third World Liberation Front, and they staged a strike. They said, we are shutting down this campus until you give us all 10 demands, including the Black Studies program. And people have been talking about the Black Studies program for a while, but hadn't been instituted yet. So that was kind of a raw issue on campus. The strike brought it to the fore, and then they held a strike. And then it was a very, very lengthy battle. It lasted from November of 1968 to March of 1969. It was a five-month-long student strike. The student activists did actually manage to shut down the campus a few times. They actually succeeded. They would actually send what are called enforcement squads to patrol the campus to make sure people weren't teaching. This was such a stressful incident that the president of San Francisco State College actually quit in the middle of a meeting with Ronald Reagan, who was governor. So that's the kind of stress level that was happening on campus. Then what happened, they had a president called Shinichi Hayakawa. He was a conservative English professor on campus, and he became president because Reagan wanted somebody on his side to fight his battle on campus. And then what Hayakawa, this new college president, did was to crack down on students. He cracked down on students. He yanked various funds for student clubs and the student newspaper. Various people were arrested and expelled from campus. And after three or four months of this, the student coalition kind of surrendered. And he said, look, here's the deal. I'll give you Black Studies. I'll give you financial aid for some Black students. But George Murray is never coming back. And he was already in trouble with the law over an unrelated issue. And the student said, deal. You know, please do not, you know, do not expel us in exchange for giving us these things. And that's how the first Black Studies Department got started.
Okay. And so, and we also in context, maybe a lot of people know already, but this is around 1967, 68, the Vietnam War is raging.
Right.
There's a draft and there is a lot of change. And the statement by Murray, if that was
George
his
Murray,
is of you know, it's all right to shoot black soldiers. While that is certainly above and beyond the realm of proper speech, there was a lot of feeling among the campus that the Vietnam War was wrong. So the students say, okay, now we want a Black Studies movement. Now, how did that benefit their Third World Liberation Front?
Well, the Third World Liberation Front was organized around that set of demands. Specifically, their biggest issue was to institutionalize and bring these courses to campus and to make it a permanent part of the curriculum. What had happened for about 2 years before the Third World Strike was that there were student-run courses. So like if you were a student, you could set up a course on, say, Black history or jazz or some aspect of African-American culture. And so what the strike did for the Third World Liberation Front was it allowed those courses to transition from being ad hoc servings of the university curriculum to a permanent part of the curriculum. And to become a real department with real professors, a real department chair, eventually graduate work and so forth, and to make it on equal footing with, say, English or history or mathematics or computer science or engineering. And that was really what the political struggle over Black Studies was about, to say, look, this form of education, which is about our history, our culture, deserves the same respect as studying the classics, studying the Greeks, or studying sociology. And that's what the Third World Liberation Front was all about, making that transition happen.
Now, in your book, you talk about how they were able to make blacks, and this happened at other campuses as well.
Correct.
But also in the book, you do some great case studies on how at some campuses the Black Studies movement thrives, and at other movements the Black Studies movement kind of dies out a little bit. Can you talk about that, please, Professor Rojas?
Yeah, absolutely. What I was really interested in was the long-term consequence of a social movement. So I wasn't just interested in what happened in 1968. I was interested in what happened in 1978. When the people with pickets went away, what happened, right? That's, I think, a very crucial question that we need to understand better. And so what I did, as David was mentioning, was I conducted a few case studies. I looked at a couple of universities, three universities, Harvard, the University of Chicago, and the University of Illinois in Chicago. Because those three universities are all research schools, they're all fairly well-funded. The University of Illinois is a lot newer compared to the other two, but still a research campus. They're all in urban settings, and they all had Black student activism where Black students were pushing for Black studies. So you've got three great case studies. And so you have a case of failure at the University of Chicago. The whole thing just fizzled after a while. You had a case of kind of stasis, which is the typical thing that happened where you got a program, but it didn't quite grow. That's the University of Illinois. And then you had kind of an up and down pattern at Harvard where they did well for a couple of years, then they crashed, and then they got revived 20 years later. So these three cases are really great comparisons because you can see the different outcomes and the different factors that go into strengthening an academic program and making the impact of a social movement last over decades.
I see. So can you make your movement last? Well, what was different at the different universities?
Right. So there are a couple of things that really come into play. One is what I call bureaucratic skill. And this is something that a lot of people within social movements don't quite appreciate, which is that the skills that you need to run a social movement are not the same skills that you need to run an academic program. So in other words, protesting in front of the corporation is way different than being inside the corporation. And the people outside the movement will say, you're selling out. And the people inside say, no, we're not selling out. We're learning how to survive. And so that's what really the book is about, making that jump, going from protest to survival within the mainstream. And so the case that I always love talking about is the Harvard University Department. And that's a great case where you can clearly see where there are a lot of resources. Harvard is the wealthiest university in the history of the world. They have some of the most brilliant students, the most brilliant faculty there. And they had sympathetic administrators. So the deans in the late 60s and early 70s were willing to give black studies a chance. This isn't to say that everybody was on board. There was a lot of stiff opposition. But the point is, you had something to work with. But the department, by the late 70s, had really contracted. There, at one point in the 80s, they had only one professor and one student in the major. By any measurement at all, that is not a good outcome. And one thing I attributed to was that the first chair that they had hired after the establishment of the department in 1969 was a guy named Ewart Guinier. Ewart Guinier.
Okay.
Ewart Guinier was Lonnie Guinier's father.
Oh, Lonnie Guinier, the person that...
The Clinton nominated.
That Clinton threw under the bus when Clarence Thomas accused...
Anita Hill, but...
I'm sorry?
No, Lonnie Guinier was nominated for a position, I believe, in the Department of Justice. And her nomination was derailed because she wrote some provocative things in a law school review article.
Which were...
I think she had this idea that... it had something to do with the way that ethnic minorities were redistricted in terms of congressional elections.
Okay.
I'm not certain about that, but I believe it's in that realm. But anyway, okay. But Lonnie Guinier was actually one of the students who promoted black studies in 1969.
Okay.
And then they start looking for a chair because you need somebody to run the program.
And her father.
Right. And her father showed up. And if you look at the records, it turns out he was not their first choice. Why? Because you want somebody with a PhD to run the program. Why? Because if you have a PhD, it means you've completed the training, you're knowledgeable in the subject. And so they approached John Hope Franklin, who is a professor at the University of Chicago. John Hope Franklin, there are a few other people whose names I don't remember. But anyway, none of the people they approached were willing to come to Harvard to run the program. And so they said, what about Ewart Guinier? He's a Harvard graduate. He has a JD. He's a lawyer. He's a very well-respected lawyer. He worked for unions. So he had kind of a progressive background, and he had a Harvard education. So they said, well, let's start with him.
Okay.
Let's start with him. And what happened was that he was not able to manage the conflicts around the department and defuse things in a way that will allow him to grow the program. There were a lot of other subtle things that happened. So, for example, he did not he was not able to help the junior faculty get promoted to senior faculty. That created a lot of problems.
So they left.
So the point is, for good or ill, whether it's his fault or not, we can discuss that more. But he did not have the academic skill, the professional skill. Now later, who revived the program? Henry Louis Gates, who is the complete opposite, not in terms of quality of person, but in terms of being a real academic entrepreneur. It is hard to find another professor who has a sterling set of credentials as Henry Louis Gates. He is a well-published scholar. He's been on every major committee in the humanities. Nobody questions that he is one of the most accomplished scholars of his generation. He set the agenda in many ways in the study of African-American literature. And also, he was really good at fundraising and making connections and whatnot. And so when he came in, he spent a year traveling between Duke, where he was teaching, to Harvard to kind of get to know the place. And yeah, when he got there, there were a lot of tough times. people still opposed the department. It was still stigmatized because of the politics of the 60s and whatnot, and still true today to some extent. But when Henry Louis Gates came in, he really knew how to work the system because he was a very skilled academic entrepreneur. And so he was the person who started recruiting his friends to come. Once you get the high-profile friends to come in, they attract high-quality students. High-quality students, high-quality professors means more money shows up, and the Harvard name legitimizes it. And so he had a really deep understanding of how Harvard is put together as an institution, which a lawyer, even though he graduated from Harvard, but that was not his job. He was a lawyer, not a professor.
So when Henry Louis Gates put together this department at Harvard, the Black Studies Department at Harvard, did that help Black Studies as a whole throughout the nation?
Not quite.
Okay.
Let me tell you why in a nutshell, which is that Black Studies departments face a real uphill battle because they came from social movements. And the issue with Harvard was that once Harvard got a department, other elite universities wanted to do the same thing. So, there was a rejuvenation at Princeton. There was a rejuvenation at Northwestern. A lot of the schools which let Black Studies kind of wither said, here's $10 million. Here's $20 million. What can you do with that money? Because we read about this in the New York Times. Now, that affected the top of the academic system, but not the middle or the bottom. So if you look at a lot of smaller state schools where the Black Studies program may be, say, two professors and a few students in the major, which is normal for a small liberal arts program, that's not a bad thing. That's just normal. There is no way that somebody's going to just give them $5 million or $10 million because they read about it in the New York Times. So the Harvard Dream Team, as it was called, had a huge impact on Yale, Northwestern, Michigan, and so forth, but only at the top of the system, not the middle or the bottom.
We're nearing the end of the interview, Professor Rojas, and I've really enjoyed talking to you. I want to ask one question. So you mentioned before that it's different being on the outside with your placards protesting rather than being inside the institution, and you mentioned that sometimes people outside would say that you've sold out to get inside the institution. But in your book, you make a different conclusion. You say that the Black Studies movement was not co-opted by the institution, but it provides a valuable counter space. What do you mean by that?
Right. So in essence, you can think of two extreme outcomes, that you never give anything to the mainstream. You refuse to give anything. The other outcome is that you give the mainstream everything. What I argue is that a lot of social movements get into an intermediate position. They kind of wedge themselves in the system. The system doesn't quite accept them, but that's enough of an entry point so that you can build a counterpoint to the mainstream. And I call that a social movement counter center.
And exactly what do you mean by that?
It's some sort of smaller institution inside a bigger institution that represents an alternative viewpoint.
And in this case, in Black Studies, what would that alternative viewpoint be?
So, for example, it would emphasize a kind of scholarship and teaching that focuses on the African-American experience rather than making it more generic, as you'd find in, say, a sociology program or an economics program. This is about this specific history and that particular perspective. And even though it's not accepted by everyone in the university, it now has a place.
And we've got about 30 seconds or so, but how would you conclude our talk today?
Well, I would say my big message is that social movements have a big impact by protesting and organizing and getting a foothold in the mainstream, which they can then develop.
Totally cool. Professor Fabio Rojas, Professor of Sociology in the Indiana University Department of Sociology, thank you for being on Interchange.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morris. The executive producer is Chad Carruthers. Original theme music by Jamil Effiam. And if you've listened to this show and enjoy it and want to tell somebody else about it, you can always tell them to go to the website, which is www.wfhb.org, and there's a search engine, and you could type in Rojas, R-O-J-A-S, and this interview will come up. Please stay tuned for Stardust with Tillman coming up next on WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of community radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.